I'm Mike Collins. Join Charlotte Talks as we take our local news roundup across the border to South Carolina on Friday, February 28th. We'll broadcast live from Amelie's in Rock Hill. We'll talk about the South Carolina primary and the top Charlotte stories of the week. For information, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Election season is about to swing into high gear. After a primary and two caucuses, the nation is turning its attention this weekend to South Carolina's primary and then to the Super Tuesday states, including ours, that go to the polls next Tuesday. The national media have spread out to cover these locations, and NPR's Steve Inskeep is here. He hosted his portion of Morning Edition at our studios as part of a nationwide series on the election that began today. And we asked him to stop by so we could talk about this election year, media coverage of it, and about his new book called Imperfect Union, about America's Civil War. Not this one. The previous one. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to Charlotte.
I'm glad to be here, Mike.
You have adopted us, I'm told. I heard your piece this morning.
You have
adopted Charlotte.
I hope Charlotte is okay with that. What we mean by that is we want to pay special attention to this metro area. It's one of a number of cities across this country that my NPR colleagues and I are paying special focus to, with the help of people at the member stations, and folks here at WFAE are helping with this project. And the idea is to get a deeper sense of what people's concerns are about their community and about the direction of the country and how where you live affects the way that you vote. And we're going to key places, and North Carolina is absolutely a key place. You mentioned Super Tuesday. We know all about the Republican convention being here, and everybody here knows that North Carolina is likely to be a presidential battleground state in the fall.
How many cities are you going to run the country?
I believe it is about 9. I'm sure that's something that might be adjusted over the course of the year. But this is the first one. And I'm proud that it's the first one, and we're looking forward to coming back.
Why us?
Charlotte is, first, a fascinating place in the metropolis of North Carolina, the most important city, I'll say, with respect to other cities in North Carolina. Huge banking center, huge population center, and a place that's growing and changing in ways that represent the way that America is growing and changing. And so it seems to us to be a place to get a picture of the changing economy, of different kinds of social issues and cultural issues that people wrestle with, and the way that different kinds of people try to coexist, and the way that different kinds of people struggle for different forms of equality, too.
So you're here. I know you've brought a reporter. Several producers have traveled here with you as well, because it takes a phalanx of people to do network
radio.
To do it right.
Yes, and we're talking to different voters simultaneously in different parts of town.
Yeah. So what have you learned? I know you've only been here for a short while, and you're coming back for more.
Yeah.
But what have you learned? Anything that surprised you? Anything that seemed out of beyond your expectations?
First, I want to tell you of the impression coming in from the airport. And it's an airport that I, as you would imagine, I've changed flights in 1,000 times. And I've just never been into town. And when you come in, the skyline of this city stuns you. And I'm just saying that local people may know that, or maybe you see it so often you get used to it and it doesn't amaze you anymore. It's an amazing skyline. And you immediately think, wow, what a fascinating city. What a prosperous city. And even if you knew that Charlotte was a prosperous city, to see it and to walk the downtown streets are great. The second thing to learn, though, which many local people here will know, is of the inequality of the city, and of that study a few years ago that found of the 50 largest cities, Charlotte was 50th for upward mobility, for the opportunity to move up in the world. And you have people living within sight of those amazing skyscrapers who don't feel like they're making enough money. And we went a little bit further out into the edges of the metro area. On this particular trip, we were as far out as Kings Mountain on the west side of the metro area. And you find people who are worried about the minimum wage or worried about health care, just worried about basic things for how to make a living and get by.
And just listening to the various interviews that you did here with Hugh McCall and several people from just the various walks of life in the urban area and Kings Mountain, which is a more rural area, you were able to experience the red-blue rural urban divide.
Which is one of the great divides in America right now. You have interconnected economies. I mean, we were talking with a farmer in Kings Mountain, and I think we will hear her as we go through the coming days. There'll be more coverage from the Charlotte metro area. And she's a farmer. She's in a different world, it seems, than Charlotte, but she's selling at a farmer's market, selling her beef at a farmer's market in the middle of Charlotte. Those economies are connected. People are beginning to find Charlotte a little too expensive for them in some cases and moving a little bit farther out. And there is at least talk of more real estate development out Kings Mountain way. Mm-hmm. We didn't see a lot of that going on right now, but people talk about it. And so there's an interconnection, but there's also a tremendous cultural divide. We found people in the center city that were worried about equality, that were worried about economic issues, that were worried about questions like racial justice and thinking about the wider world. And in the Kings Mountain area, we found some of that, but we're also more likely to find people who are concerned about abortion or concerned about gun rights and concerned about what you would think of as cultural issues. We were in one of the restaurants we were in, the waitress was wearing a T-shirt that said something like, "Hey, snowflake," you know, and it was just like a bunch of slogans on the back reminding people that they don't get everything their way and to stop complaining quite so much. And it was just a different cultural attitude than we might find in a different part of town.
You also talked to somebody who pretty well illustrated, I think, the fact that we have extremes of both parties running in this election. We had Donald Trump, who was a complete outlier 4 years ago, and who's taken their party, the Republican Party, in a very different direction from previous Republican parties.
Yeah.
And then you have the front runner on the Democratic side, at least at the moment, Bernie Sanders. And people are a little on the fence. The couple of the people that you talked to were as concerned as some Democratic Party leaders are that if this guy gets the nomination, people may not vote against Trump. They may just either sit it out or they may vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, this is the dilemma that Democrats face. And we should be frank, as journalists and as citizens more broadly, we don't quite know the answer. One argument is that for Democrats, Bernie Sanders could be great because he will energize more progressive people and bring newer and younger voters into the party.
Who have to vote because they don't traditionally vote.
In big numbers, that's absolutely true. And that Bernie Sanders will generate a certain amount of excitement. But on the flip side is, does he drive away people who are more moderate and just think that Bernie Sanders is a little too extreme? And your own Steve Harrison of WFAE interviewed twice a woman who gave slightly different answers to that question. Yeah. She's really wrestling with the question. She's really against President Trump, but could she really vote for Sanders? She doesn't quite seem sure.
What does it tell you? Because you've been covering politics in America for a long time. I think 1996, when you first came to NPR, you covered the New Hampshire primary, in which I took a note here. Bob Dole, Pat Buchanan, Steve Forbes, Lamar Alexander, Dick Lugar, and Alan Keyes were candidates.
Different world.
Yes, very different world. But what does it tell you about America that 4 years ago, Republicans clung to Donald Trump and continue to do so as though they're barnacles on the side of a ship, and Democrats are gravitating toward the extreme left of their party? What does it tell you about the state of American politics?
We have a more and more polarized electorate. That's not news to anybody. We have polarized media.
But why?
Well, one thing that I think is overlooked is the decline of local media, because the local Democratic Party, your local Republican Party, may be a little different than the national party. But as local newspapers have become weaker and lost a lot of their staffs or even gone out of business in some cases, the media coverage that we consume has become more national. And if your national source of news is, say, a cable television news station, it may have a particular partisan bent. And certain national issues can be very divisive, and people feel more divided. And so you do see that. I want to mention another thing, though. When you talk about Republicans clinging to President Trump, that is baffling to people who are not Republicans. That is baffling to even some Republicans who have peeled away from him. But party loyalty is a big deal. It always has been in America. I can go back through history and find a case where Theodore Roosevelt, one of our great presidents, as a young man, backed a Republican presidential candidate he hated and thought was corrupt because it was better for his career to stick with his party.
And you ended your piece today with an interesting comment that I think is illustrative of trust, the level of trust or lack of trust in the national media. And I know there was some debate at NPR about whether you should end the piece that way. I'm a little behind the scenes.
We were working on editing it.
And that was the comment that when you went to Kings Mountain and talked to people in a restaurant, the conservatives made a point of telling you the conservatives were going to pick up your tab.
Yeah, this was a very, very nice family. That,
what do you think that meant?
They wanted to send the message, we're friendly and hospitable people, and you're an outsider, which I am, and maybe they think I'm more politically liberal than them. I'm not going to talk about my politics, but they just wanted the world to know that they're okay people, even though somebody may look down on them for carrying weapons or opposing abortion or being Baptist or any number of things that they are. And I found it hospitable. I should tell you, though, I have intended all along to include that detail. It was just a question of which of the many stories we're going to do over the next several days that we'll get that in. And we got it in today.
Last night was the final debate before Super Tuesday in Charleston, South Carolina. And as I watched it, it was exciting television, but I'm not sure that's the way we should be choosing our presidents. I'd like to get your point of view on this. We audition these people through these fake debates, which are really very bad interviews. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the candidates get criticized for not talking about news of the day that may be developing, like the coronavirus situation. Yeah. What would you do about it? Well, they did talk about it a little bit, but they've been criticized for not doing that. But they don't control the conversation. Moderators control the conversation. And it's very artificial. Should we be doing it this way?
I would like to see them done differently. And there's a specific rule that I will call out. In the last couple of debates, maybe in a bunch of them, the candidates have been allowed a minute and 15 seconds to answer, and then somebody gets 45 seconds for a rebuttal. It's just not long enough.
Right.
It invites sound bites. I guess it's better than if it was 30 seconds, but it's still kind of bad.
Yeah.
I would rather people talk a little bit longer. I think that a lot of voters have the attention span for that, and they would appreciate hearing from them at greater length. One suggestion I would like to make, have a debate on NPR. Which has happened in the past. I'd be totally in favor of a presidential debate on NPR. When we had the last one, and it was several elections ago, the reviews came back very positive, that it was very substantive, that it was a very different kind of conversation without the television cameras by design so that you could focus on people's words and their thoughts.
If you go back to the 1960 debate between Nixon and Kennedy, if you didn't watch the picture Nixon won, if you watched the picture Kennedy won, so it does change the story, I suppose. So we're in this very divided time, and you have chosen to take this very divided time in which we live to write a book about a different divided time in our history, about the Civil War. It's called Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. In his time, John Fremont was called one of the three most important figures since Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's true.
I remember seeing Fremont's name on street signs in California. But that's all I know about him. So who was he?
His name is on a lot of things. Fremont, California. Fremont Street in Las Vegas. There's a lot of Fremont streets across the country and towns of Fremont. He was a Western explorer who went out in the 1840s and 50s, before the Civil War, and mapped parts of the West and mapped the Oregon Trail and went to California and didn't actually, as an explorer, discover all that much that was new. But what he did was popularize the West. He came back and wrote best-selling accounts of his adventures. And he did that with his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont.
Who you said was the brains behind the operation.
In some ways, yes. She was the daughter of a senator, very ambitious, which I mean in a positive way, and wanted to be involved in what was considered men's issues, like politics and so forth. She worked through her husband, and she was sometimes his editor, sometimes his secretary, sometimes his ghostwriter and political advisor and publicist. Mm. And they generated fame for him even as he was making these explorations. And fame was sort of the point. They were publicizing moving west. And along the way, they publicized him and made him super famous.
Yes, I did not know this. I don't know how I didn't know this. I always thought that the first candidate on the Republican ticket for president was Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. It was not. It was 1856. It was John Fremont.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he came along at a time when the divide over slavery was really heating up.
Yeah.
And his party, the Republican Party, was the first party to come out against slavery.
Yeah.
So he was the guy that helped promote the fact that we were not going to have slavery.
Yeah. Now we should say that they were against the expansion of slavery, and they were the first big national party to oppose the expansion of slavery. It was a very racist time. We should be frank about that. But it's relevant to now because it was divided America. The North had gradually abolished slavery. The South still embraced it. We should be clear that everybody in the country was implicated in some way in this economy that involved slaves. But there was this divide, and there was a demographic change going on. The North was becoming way more populist, which meant it was way more powerful, and it became possible to elect an anti-slavery candidate with Northern votes alone. That's what Fremont tried to do. Didn't quite make it. James Buchanan defeated him. But Lincoln tried the same path and succeeded 4 years later. And that demographic change is a big part of the story of how slavery ultimately was ended in America. It's relevant now because we're going through big demographic changes now, which have political implications.
And it's almost the same. The North was populated with cities, and the South was agricultural and rural at the time. So we're going through the same urban-rural divide.
Yeah, although, of course, here we are in a great metropolis, a great city, which is in the South. And so things are not quite so distinct. But if you look at the red and blue map of the 2016 election, you can see those urban and rural areas pretty clearly.
I have less than a minute left, and I want to ask you about NPR's Morning Edition, because it's become one of the most listened to radio programs in the country.
Yeah.
And you've taken over the world of morning radio, from morning zoos and shock jocks and things like that, to this serious, interesting, introspective news program. How did that happen?
I am grateful to be working with so many great colleagues, but I think the key to the program is that we respect the audience. We think that people actually want to hear the answers to the questions that we ask. And we also insist on answers to those questions and ask them again and again and again. We want to hear all points of view. That doesn't mean we're treating both sides equally or whatever. I mean, some people may be more truthful than others, but we want to push hard questions on everyone and make sure that everyone has a chance to answer. But also, we're adding context so the audience can make up their own minds as to who really answered the question.
NPR's Steve Inskeep, host of Morning Edition, will be back in Charlotte as his series on the election continues. And I want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Glad to do it. Thank you very much.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.